How we feel matters to the economy. Feeling good can lead to positive movement. Same goes for negative feelings. But what affects how we feel about the economy?
The state of the job market is probably one of the most important indicators of confidence or reflections of confidence.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, critics accuse the EPA of overreach on new water rules, how Arizona rates in clinical trials. We talk to the producer of a new documentary about battling cartels, and things get a bit chippy.
Once the weather changes and it starts to get warm, with a swift weather change like that, you know, those little chips on your windshield don't have much of a chance. You know, they tend to spread out.
Plus, we go into the Shark Tank and Yuke's. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I am Mark Brody. Going right to Valley traffic, the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway is closed at Loop 101, traffic being taken off the 202 westbound to go onto the 101 either north or southbound. Elsewhere, I-17 northbound, the left lane is blocked at the I-10 split. We're looking for sunny skies for the rest of the day and through the weekend as well. Look for a high today of 101, up to 104 for a high tomorrow, 106 on Sunday. Right now, it's mostly sunny, 99 degrees at KJZZ. Following an investigation by a federal agency, the Arizona State Hospital is taking steps to correct dozens of highly critical deficiencies. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services had threatened to revoke the hospital's Medicare provider agreement unless the Arizona Department of Health Services submitted a plan of correction. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie has more.
The Arizona State Hospital has been in the news for the past several months after a media investigation found the hospital failed to keep patients safe and engaged in misconduct. At least six top hospital and Department of Health officials were replaced. Now steps are being taken by new leadership to correct those serious deficiencies. Dr. Kara Christ is the director of the Department of Health.
We've changed our policy on rounding and close monitoring. We've added people. We've added cameras. We've bought new radios. We've increased the number of staffing that are on what we call our mall.
That outdoor mall area was also mentioned in the report. Quote, patients were on mall, no visual check was done, no radio confirmation was done. Staffing, however, was just one of many issues. A patient who was supposed to be monitored had sex with another patient in exchange for a soda. A nurse failed to provide wound care, and then there was the issue of staff being afraid to come forward. Dr. Christ.
Obviously, we want to have a culture of transparency and bringing things forward, because Dr. Bowen, who's the new CEO, and I believe that if you don't know about problems, you can't fix them.
The Department of Health submitted its plan of correction late last month. After CMS approves its proposed measures, they'll return to the hospital to see if those changes have been put in place. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
New numbers from ASU show homebuilders took out 45% more permits this April and May than the same months last year. Joining me to talk about what the report found is KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Mark.
So before we dive in, can you explain why it is that we're even talking about permits?
Sure. So as we all know, one of the biggest ways housing experts determine how the market's doing is by looking at home prices. But when we talk about new homes, price is a little bit more misleading because the price of one that sells in, like, I don't know, say May, is really more reflective of the market 6 or 8 months ago when the buyer and the home builder initially went under contract. So we look at new home permits issued because there's a lag of only a month or two with the data, which gives us more up-to-date information on how much activity or lack of activity home builders are seeing.
So why did the Valley see such a big jump in permits in April and May?
Well, the market had slowed down last year because buyer demand was pretty low, but it really started to pick up in February, and it's stayed strong ever since. That obviously started having ripple effects on home building, too, which is why we saw the rise in permits, and that really shows that builders are feeling more confident about the future. But it should be noted that the 45% increase in permits isn't actually that much when we look at the actual numbers. Here's Mike Orr, ASU's housing expert, who writes the reports.
It's not a dramatic number of permits. It's a decent percentage increase, but it's still only, we're in the sort of 1,400, 1,500 a month. So we've gone from like a third of normal to a half of normal.
So why is home building having such a hard time recovering?
Well, there are several reasons. A big one is price. Price of new homes and existing homes traditionally were pretty comparable. But since the bust, new home prices are substantially higher. Another big reason that Orr mentioned when I spoke to him is lack of construction workers. It's a nationwide problem, but especially so in Arizona.
That's a constraint on how fast they can build new homes. There are very few people entering those trades as youngsters. And, of course, most of the Latinos who were doing that 10 years ago have been sort of either found a job somewhere else or have gone away.
Well, so that leads to the big question, Christina. What does that mean for the future?
Well, that's hard to say. Orr thinks that we're still several years away from getting back to historical norms. But things like this are really tough to predict because housing is a very reactive industry. It's hard to know how home builders are going to feel by the end of this year, let alone 5 years from now.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
How confident people feel seems to be a big part of the economy. When producers feel like things are going well, they're likely to produce more. And when consumers are confident, they tend to buy more. Lynn Franco tracks that sort of thing. She's the Director of Economic Indicators for the Conference Board and oversees the group's monthly Consumer Confidence Report. The report asks people about both their current situations and their outlook for the future.
Well, I think based on these questions, we sort of narrow in on what's happening in terms of business conditions so that we get a feel for what's happening. And in terms of employment, they're sort of, you know, the first on the ground to relay to us, you know, whether or not they're seeing sort of an improvement or the opposite. So we get, I think, sort of a good read of both in terms of what's happening in terms of the business environment and also in terms of employment. And that then translates sort of into their income expectations as well.
How much do you think it matters the way in which information is presented? In other words, if somebody says, oh, economic indicator X is up 5% and that's fantastic versus, oh, economic indicator X is up 5%, it should be more than that. I mean, does that matter to how people perceive what is going on out there?
It can to a certain extent. I mean, obviously, if consumers are being barraged with bad news, that's going to have sort of a negative impact on their expectations. I think the real key from the survey and what we've seen, let's say, even from historical shocks, whether it's gas prices or the stock market or a hurricane, is that they tend to have sort of a temporary effect on confidence. So it could be anywhere from a rule of thumb, generally from 1 to 4 months. If there's not sort of economic consequences, then confidence sort of tends to rebound to prior levels. So I think the real key is not only in looking at obviously what's happening month to month and what's happening within the components themselves, but the trend is also important.
Do you find that when consumer confidence is lower, that as it gets higher, as it's sort of picking up, that people sort of make their purchases, you know, going from smaller to progressively bigger?
It really depends. If we've had a severe downturn in confidence, consumers do tend then to sort of postpone big ticket item purchases. So it really depends on the trend and also their ability to make purchases. But obviously, if we have very low levels of confidence, that's not going to translate into strong spending.
Are there particular economic factors that consumers tend to look at or look for when sort of gauging how confident they're going to be and looking to see how that information is presented to them?
Well, I think our survey sort of narrows it down to what's happening in terms of employment. I mean, that's a key component for consumer confidence, both current and future. So the state of the job market is probably one of the most important indicators of confidence or reflections of confidence. And then I think there is also a variety of other factors that depending on the consumer themselves. For instance, after this last recession, what we saw, which generally doesn't happen, was there was a sharp decline across, let's say, consumers of all groups. Because consumers were hit on the job front, they were also hit in terms of home prices, and they were hit in terms of financial assets. As we began to see the stock market recover and the housing market recover, with the last sort of leg being employment, we've seen that consumers, the more affluent consumers, are much more confident than the less affluent. And part of that is because we've not seen wage growth. So there are factors, depending on the economic status of the consumer, that will have a sort of greater impact.
Lynn Franco is Director of Economic Indicators for the Conference Board. She oversees the monthly Consumer Confidence Report. Lynn, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
There are several challenges to a new rule issued by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency dealing with the Clean Water Act. The EPA says the rule is meant to clarify the act after two rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court, which called into question how the law applies to smaller bodies of water and streams around the country. Critics, though, accuse the agency of overreach. Speaking last month, Ken Kaposis with the EPA Office of Water said the rule was necessary to clarify the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act, which is the nation's premier statute to protect water quality.
We think it's a critical issue for protecting public health. And these are also the water bodies that feed the larger downstream water bodies. And we know that you can't protect the larger water bodies from pollution if you don't protect the upper water bodies that feed into them.
Kaposis says EPA is not attempting to expand the scope of the Clean Water Act and that the rule officials are replacing was actually broader in its application than the new one. He says the rule only applies to those directly affecting the waterways.
The Clean Water Act does not affect what people do on land. It only affects what people do in or on the water. So if you're not planning to put pollution or you're not planning to fill in a waterway, then the Clean Water Act doesn't apply. So whether that water is jurisdictional or not for someone who wants to build a home, as long as they don't put materials into the water, they're free to do that, and the Clean Water Act is irrelevant to them.
But last week, Arizona joined a number of other states in a lawsuit challenging the new rule on just those grounds. Separately, the National Association of Home Builders also sued. Spencer Camps is Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Home Builders of Central Arizona.
Under the Clean Water Act, the federal government has the authority to regulate to ensure pollutants don't enter the system of waters of the U.S., and that's under the Commerce Clause, so the interstate authority of the Commerce Clause allows them to regulate waters of the U.S. or traditional navigable waters. And EPA, through this rule, has overreached its authority in the sense that it also needs to regulate what's called other waters, traditional waters, adjacent waters, basically any connection to those traditional navigable waters. And in the arid Southwest, as you can imagine, we only have water in many of these washes for, 6 to 10 days out of the year. And those terms I used are obviously undefined. We don't know what other waters are or what adjacent waters are, hence the concern over the regulatory reach of the federal government. But prior to this new rule, that was defined as a wash as little as 1 foot wide. And when you have, and especially in the Phoenix area, when you have the fact that none of this water in any of these washes can actually get to a traditional navigable water, why should the federal government be regulating it?
So EPA says that unless a body of water actually does connect to a larger stream or lake or ocean or some other larger body of water, that it will not have jurisdiction, it will not be regulating that particular perhaps temporary body of water. It sounds like that would kind of alleviate your concerns.
Yeah, but that's not what the rule says. The rule says specifically that they will be regulating, like I said, other waters and adjacent waters and tributaries. And let me give you an example why we oppose this, mostly because what we believe it's turned into a land regulatory rule, not a water rule, is the Haciampa River Basin area. That's over 1,400 square miles, and that drains into the Gila River, which is a traditional navigable water under the definition of EPA's rule. And you're gonna have EPA regulating tributaries and washes up to, I guess, 1 foot wide that are hundreds of miles from the Gila River in an effort to prevent pollutants, which silt is a pollutant under the Clean Water Act, and that is a good thing because that was done to prevent salmon from dying in the state of Washington when construction happened and somebody let it rain and silt would enter a clear stream and it would choke the salmon. That's a valid concern and appropriate use of the Clean Water Act. But in Arizona, that doesn't apply. You know, good luck trying to prevent silt from entering a wash when it rains here in the Phoenix area. And so we're going to be regulated literally, potentially hundreds of miles from the Gila River in the Hassayampa River Basin on whether we allow silt to enter a one-foot wash. We think that's a huge overreach.
Assuming that the lawsuits are not successful and this rule goes into effect, how will that change how your members have to do their business?
Well, regardless of whether the lawsuits are successful or not, at the end of the day, we need to comply in the field, and that's going to cost significant resources, both in time and money, in terms of reviews by EPA and the Corps of Engineers, in terms of permitting costs, compliance costs, and of course control costs, because we have to control our silt on our construction sites to make sure they don't enter these washes.
Spencer Camps is Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Home Builders of Central Arizona.
In recent years, Arizona has become more of a haven for cancer treatment and biomedical research. That's also led to it becoming more competitive in the realm of clinical trials. Ashwini Roy Chowdhury is the Director of Clinical Research at the University of Arizona. I asked her to give us the basics on what a clinical trial is.
So in a nutshell, a clinical trial is taking a bench to bedside. So there you would have heard a lot of people doing lab work and finding new drugs and or in developing new devices. That has to get to the patient through a various different methodologies. The FDA mandates that you have clinical trials before we can make them official and approved to be used on human subjects or humans. Think of it as a layperson might think clinical trials is like, oh my God, I don't want to be a guinea pig. You're not. We have to go through strict regulations and rules and regulations to actually test a drug or a device on a human subject. It is mandated by a body called the Institutional Review Board, or the IRB, for any university. And they have to approve the protocol, which is a living document of how the trial is going to be conducted, what the risks and benefits are, as well as with it is the informed consent form, where each person is informed about what they're signing up for.
Do clinical trials vary in length depending on what is being studied?
A drug trial might be anywhere, depends between, short as one day to follow-up visits that could last for 5 years. In clinical trials, it's not always drugs and devices either. It could be observational. People want to see what happens to, say, kids who've got a cardiac condition and what happens to their kidneys 10 years down the line. So we have follow-up visits for 10 years. They're observational. We just collect, the procedures would not be intervention. They would just be trying to observe them and see what happens to them. So you kind of develop guidelines as how to deal with patients for the future if someone comes with a cardiac disease.
I imagine we've seen great advances in clinical trials as more are going on, as technology advances. Are there some obvious changes you could tell us about?
There is a larger number of awareness of what clinical trials are. The ability to have patients be aware of what the new drug is on the market that is being tested is also something new that we've seen. One thing would be that we would have patients sitting in waiting areas in the waiting room and talk to the patient next to them and say, are you on this drug? That is the communication that we've never seen before. It was always, how do we get patients enrolled into a clinical trial? So it's not only do we do the work up front, but we've seen that patients are extremely aware of what drugs and new drugs that are on the market, and they want to get in on them.
Is that good or bad? Does that come with challenges of its own?
Oh, sure it does, because it's like, we are always under this HIPAA umbrella that, you don't have to discuss, it's all confidential. The biggest challenge is that what do you do when a patient says, I want to be on the drug that the patient that I just spoke to in the waiting room is on. The other concept that has come up is that each disease population has websites, and they are a medium for communicating what new trials are on, what new drugs are on. So patients have access to that as well. And then they would go to their doctor and say, you know, I've heard this, I've seen this on the, you know, Crohn's disease website, or and how do I get onto that drug? Or I've heard about this new study, am I eligible to participate?
I know you're a relative newcomer to Arizona. I'm wondering, is this a place that, whether it's University of Arizona or more generally, is this a place that seems to be, I don't want to say ahead of the curve, but in the curve as it relates to clinical trials and advancing that? We've certainly heard a lot about cancer research being done here.
Definitely. You have to remember university is divided by the different departments. So like you said, cancer will have a higher rate because the drugs that are coming out at a much faster rate than they might come out for, say, respiratory medicine or ED care or, you know. And every university also has their faculty who are primarily interested in doing research and are also bringing clinical trials of their own to the forefront. So that would be the only difference I would say you would find different across universities. Arizona is right, I think, right on the mark. It's right in the right where it should be as compared to any university across the U.S.
Ashwini Roy-Chowdhury is the Director of Clinical Research at the U of A.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, Loop 202, the Red Mountain Freeway westbound, is closed at Loop 101. You'll have to get off the freeway on the 101, either north or southbound. Again, 202 westbound, Red Mountain Freeway closed at the 101. 99 degrees at 225.
KJZZ is supported by ASU Art Museum's Family Fun Day, Saturday, July 11th, an art celebration for the whole family with educational activities, games, and performances. No admission required. asuartmuseum.asu.edu/familyfun.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. The director of the Federal Office of Personnel Management, Catherine Archuleta, resigned today in the wake of a widely reported hack into the personal information of more than 21 million people. That's according to the latest disclosure from the Obama administration.
If you need the phone number, credit card, or possibly a peek at the latest medical history of a federal worker or anyone who has applied to be one in the last 15 months, you might try asking the Chinese. The government believes this data theft intrusion originated in China. Susan Landau, professor of cybersecurity policy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, says the vulnerability issues at the OPM preceded the arrival of Archuleta, and Landau is convinced that they will survive her by a long shot.
Of course, any head of an agency is always responsible for security. That said, the expertise has to lie in other parts of the government as well, protecting against an attack of the magnitude and sophistication of the Chinese government or people who work for the Chinese government is very hard, and OPM cannot have the expertise by itself.
What would this involve? I mean, are the OPM computers separate? Are they tied into the overall government computer security system, or is it just sort of a patchwork of different computer systems throughout Washington?
All federal systems are tied together, at least the civilian systems are tied together and communicate. We know that some of the ways that hacks have been done is to go in via a contractor. So a contractor has access to the OPM machines because the contractor is doing legitimate work for the government. But then maybe the contractor is less well protected, or somebody working from home is less well protected, maybe even less well protected when working in the office. All these are different routes for getting in.
Is it the case that the state of technology in Washington allows that a contractor with access to, say, look at charts of economic data on a government database would also be able to, with a little bit of work, find their way throughout every aspect of that agency's computer database?
No, but it could be a contractor who had access to personnel records, for example, had authorization to do something. For example, somebody to do with healthcare, somebody to do with another aspect of federal government. The point is that the U.S. government has not kept up with advances in technology in terms of security. I worked at Sun Microsystems starting in 1999, and we had what was called two-factor authentication then. I had a small device that I used when I logged in remotely, in addition to the password on my computer. Federal systems typically don't have that kind of technology even now.
And at the time you were at Sun Microsystems, the federal government was probably recovering from the fact that all of its records were on paper, and they were just beginning to digitize those records back then. How does a big agency deal with upgrading technology and the fact that, you know, there's constant turnover in the database itself? You can't stop everything to install a new system, right?
Right. So one thing is you roll out changes slowly, incrementally. A much deeper problem for the federal government is that when Congress funds purchase of equipment, it doesn't fund maintenance. It doesn't fund upkeep. And that's actually a really important aspect of keeping our systems secure. In industry, when you see a problem, you can put money towards fixing it immediately. The federal procurement process is slow, and there are reasons for that. Fairness is a really important issue for the U.S. government, making sure that you're doing bidding fairly. But it also means that you lack agility. Information about an individual makes the individual open to compromise and puts people at risk, but it also puts the federal government at risk. So I think that this is a very serious long-term risk for the U.S.
Susan Landau, professor of cybersecurity policy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, author of Surveillance or Security, The Risks Posed by New Wiretapping Technologies. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The so-called drug wars have hit Mexico hard, and in some cases they've threatened to cross into the U.S. In his new documentary, Cartel Land, director Matthew Heineman profiles two men, one Mexican and one American, who've started vigilante groups to fight drug cartels.
At the heart of this film are the leaders of these two groups, El Doctor in Mexico and Naylor, Tim Naylor Foley in Arizona. They're both 55-year-old men. They both believe that the government has failed them. And they both, you know, quote unquote, you know, taking the law into their own hands to sort of fight for what they believe in. But the circumstances are, you know, quite different. In Mexico, the violence is visceral, it's real. You know, 80,000 plus people killed since 2007, 20,000 plus people have disappeared. Whereas in Arizona, you know, we're not seeing that level of violence. We're not seeing, you know, shootouts in the streets. We're not seeing, you know, severed heads or bodies hanging from bridges. So that fight is a little bit more of a sort of fear that the Mexican drug wars will seep its way across our borders.
When you were dealing with both of them, did you have equal regard for both of them? Did you have equal understanding of where they were coming from?
I think, you know, a lot of films, when a lot of filmmakers go out and, you know, make films to sort of justify their own beliefs or to preach to the choir or, you know, that's just not what interests me. You know, what interests me is entering worlds that I've never seen before, and going places that I've never been before, speaking with characters that, you know, you sort of hear about but I've never experienced firsthand. And so, you know, I really didn't go into this film with any preconceived notions, with any agenda. You know, I wanted to experience it for myself. I guess on the Mexican side, with How to Defend Us, it seemed at first like it was this very simple hero-villain story of guys in white shirts fighting against guys in black hats. And then over time, being clear that the lines between good and evil are much more blurry than I thought.
There's an imaginary line out there between right and wrong, good and evil. I believe what I'm doing is good, and what I'm standing up against is evil.
You know, I'm intrigued by the concept of El Doctor and Naylor as people who feel so strongly that they want to get involved in this, as you mentioned, vigilante groups, for lack of a better term. Did you talk with them about the perspectives of maybe making short-term gains, but who knows, maybe it just cycles again and the drug cartels, even if maybe they lose a battle, they ultimately still retain power?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I was struck by was the cyclical nature, obviously, of this issue. Even in Michoacán, And within the case of the Autofensis, you know, they were successfully beating back the Knights Templar cartel. They're successfully you know, purging them from their towns. But, you know, what they did was they created a power vacuum. And within that power vacuum, somebody needed to fill it. Somebody needed to cook that mess that would make its way northward and be consumed by, you know, Americans up here. And so what we see in the film is that that cycle continues. Naylor in Arizona, I think, says it, you know, quite practically. You know, this is a David and Goliath battle. We're David and they're Goliath.
Matthew Heineman is the director of Cartel Land, which opens in the Valley this weekend at the Harkins Theater's Valley Art in Tempe. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
If you thought all sharks do is chomp on everything in sight, you've got the wrong idea.
Their lives are just a lot more complex than we think.
We discover the gentler side to sharks coming up. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, Loop 202, the Red Mountain Freeway westbound, still closed at the Loop 101 due to a fatal accident there. Traffic being diverted onto the 101 either north or southbound. You'll want to avoid that area if you can. Sunny skies, 99 degrees at KJZZ at 2:34.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Hawk. Crowds gathered outside the state capitol building in South Carolina today to watch the removal of the Confederate battle flag. Member station WFAE's Duncan McFadden was in Columbia as the flag was lowered.
The South Carolina State Police and Honor Guard took down the flag. They folded it and then handed it to the director of the state's Military History Museum, where the flag will be kept. We don't know if it will be displayed.
After a week of debate, South Carolina lawmakers went along with Governor Nikki Haley's call for the flag's removal after the June 17 massacre of 9 black parishioners at a Charleston church. Attorneys for the gunman behind the Aurora Theater shooting rested their case this morning, 3 months and 256 witnesses after the trial began. James Holmes has pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity for killing 12 people at a midnight premiere of The Dark Knight Rises. Colorado Public Radio's Ben Marcus reports.
The defense rested its case after showing several videos of James Holmes 4 months after the shooting. In one video, he's in jail, naked and smearing feces on the wall. His attorneys argue he has a severe form of schizophrenia, and he was legally insane at the time of the shooting in 2012. They called two psychiatric experts to bolster that case. For their part, the prosecution called two court-appointed psychiatric experts who found the opposite, that he was legally sane, that he could tell the difference between right and wrong. Soon, Holmes's fate will be in the jury's hands. Closing arguments are scheduled for Tuesday. If found guilty, he could get the death penalty. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
President Obama has accepted the resignation of Office of Personnel Management Director Catherine Archuleta. Her departure comes the day after her agency disclosed that hackers stole the personal information of more than 21 million people. On Wall Street, the Dow rose 211, the Nasdaq was up 75. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
If you live in the Valley long enough, this will most likely happen to you. You've been driving along and all of a sudden you hear it, a dull thud. A rock that's been kicked up from somewhere flew through the air and dinged your windshield. And this time of year, it seems to happen with much more frequency. For more on that, we turn to Bryant Woody. He's SafeLite Auto Glass's service delivery manager for Phoenix.
Typically every summer, once the weather changes and it starts to get warm, with a swift weather change like that, you know, those little chips on your windshield don't have much of a chance. You know, they tend to spread out.
So it really is based on the weather then. Once it gets really hot, windshields suffer more.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is with windshields and chips specifically, you know, you never know when a chip is going to crack. And we know about 90% of chips, you know, those little rock chips in your windshield from rocks on the road, 90% of them are going to spread within the first 3 years of getting them. Some are faster than others. You know, it could be a bump that you hit on your way home. It could be a weather change like we have right now. Pretty much anything can make those things spread.
Do you find that drivers tend to get more of the little chips in their windshield this time of year, that they get rocks or something else flying up at them?
You know, in Arizona, it's kind of different. We have a lot of construction, you know, just our climate in general. I mean, there's a lot of rocks out here. They end up being on the roads. You know, how often do you drive behind a big truck that, you know, happens to kick up a couple rocks? It happens all the time.
Do you have a sense of what kind of an increase you tend to see in the summer versus the rest of the year?
You know, it typically, our summers are our peak season. Once that weather kicks up, especially if it kicks up quickly, you know, the windshield expanding and contracting, that's when we get that big, you know, the big jump.
Do your techs tend to have more jobs per day during the summer than they do during the winter or other seasons?
At SafeLight, you know, we want to make sure that we're giving our techs the right amount of jobs. So typically we'll give them, you know, 6 or 7 jobs per day, regardless of the season.
So if you get more jobs during the summer, does that mean you have to hire more people?
Yeah. You know, if we see a big increase, you know, we're going to hire more. Right now, for example, we're hiring in our Chandler Contact Center for contact center associates, and we're hiring technicians in the field as well. This season's busy, and we're looking for people.
How much do you attribute the increase in work you have to monsoon activity with dust storms and other weather sort of blowing up some of the rocks?
You know, I think some of it has to go to the monsoon. I have to give credit to the monsoons, mainly because the temperature changes. You know, when the monsoon hits, all of a sudden it's cold outside. You know, your windshield.
Relatively cold.
Right.
I wouldn't say it's actually cold, but yes.
For our Arizonans, when it hits, you know, anywhere below 90, I'd say that's pretty cold for me. So once that weather change happens, then heats back up, you know, like I said earlier, the chips don't have a chance.
In other parts of the country, what is the busiest season?
You know, back east, where they get real weather, not like us out here where we get a little rain sometimes. You know, whenever it gets real cold, hailstorms are a huge, huge thing for our company. So, you know, whenever it gets cold, back east is when we really get that pickup.
Are there other places where summer is the biggest season like it is here?
Not like Phoenix, no. I mean, Phoenix is, you know, it's Phoenix. You know, we get the hottest. So our summer season is our peak.
Bryant Woody is the service delivery manager for Phoenix for SafeLight Auto Glass. Bryant, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. This was fun.
The bad news when you need a new windshield is you need a new windshield. The good news is it won't cost you anything to get it. In addition to the high temperatures and road construction, there are just more cars on the road across the country, which also leads to more cracked windshields and more glass claims. Noel Young is regional counsel for Allstate Insurance Company in the Southwest.
I don't know if it's around this time of the year, but summertime, you're having this construction work going on. There are a lot of cars, a lot of people driving, more miles being driven during the summertime. So that tends to lead to increase in glass claims.
Is that unique to Phoenix? Is that unique to Arizona? Or do you see that in other places as well?
Well, in Arizona, you actually have the highest glass claims in the country. That most probably is as a result of certain laws they have here in the state. One of them, which says insurance companies need to offer consumers zero glass deductible, which obviously leads to greater claims. And you're also in a desert. And here in Maricopa County, we're seeing a lot of construction going on, certainly after the recession. The economy is starting to come back.
Are you able to attribute any of the claims that you see to increased road construction, sort of dust and dirt and rocks getting kicked up from that?
I don't know if we can directly contribute it to that, but it's obviously something we think factors in.
When you talk to counterparts at other companies, do they find the same thing, that because of road construction, more cars on the road, that they tend to see more claims for windshields as well?
The insurance industry in general is seeing more claims, more glass claims. And a lot of that is attributable to the more miles being driven. The economy's coming back. People are getting back to work. They're on the roads. They're out driving. I would also attribute it to new car sales, too, if you think about it. If you go back 3 years ago, car sales were in the dump. Now they're almost at their all-time high. And people who have a little ding in their car, a little crack in their windshield, if it's a new car, are going to be more likely to have that damage repaired than to just let it sit there.
What's interesting is when you talk about more cars on the road, I look at the freeways in the Phoenix area over the summer, and it's like a ghost town out there compared to the cooler times of the year. You don't have tourists here. You have a lot of people who vacation elsewhere to try to beat the heat here. So it's interesting that this is, you know, when it's warmer out, there's more construction out, you're seeing that there are more people who are putting in claims.
To one point, I agree with you. You see less cars out on the road. I live up in the Scottsdale area, and you don't have the snowbirds down here. So there are fewer cars that I'm seeing out on the road, but you have more construction going on. You have more people working, and it is summertime. People are on vacation. They're out traveling. My kids are at home. My kids are out driving the streets. So I don't know if I'm saying it's directly the summertime that's causing the increase in glass, but it's a cosmopolitan of the whole thing put together.
Assuming that the economy sort of continues where it is or maybe continues to get better a little bit, would you anticipate that you'll just continue to see more and more claims? I mean, does it ever sort of just plateau?
I don't know that we're going to continue to see more and more claims. I mean, you can't judge that. That depends on what's happening out there, the people, the accidents that are occurring, and so forth. What I'm generally saying, though, is with more miles being driven, you have a tendency to see more claims. And that's what occurs. So low gas prices, people getting back to work, more miles being driven, increase in claims.
Noel Young is regional counsel for Allstate Insurance Company in the Southwest. The National Park Service has hired a new manager for the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. The law, which Congress approved in 1990, requires museums and other institutions that get federal money to go through their collections and repatriate human remains and other cultural items to the tribes to whom they belong. Melanie O'Brien has been working on the NAGPRA program for a few years and is its new manager.
Some institutions have had great success in going through their collections and repatriating or returning objects and human remains to tribes. There are a number of institutions that have removed all human remains from their collections.
Are there some that are doing less well?
There are others that have larger collections that take more time. There are institutions that have a significant amount of unidentifiable human remains that require a different process in order to get them returned to tribes.
Do you ever find that institutions are reluctant to do this, that they feel like, hey, these are part of our collections, people come here to see them, we would like to keep them here on display?
No, I've never encountered that attitude from anyone involved in NAGPRA, even at institutions that still have large collections. They have always expressed a desire to adhere to the law and to comply with the spirit of the law and to follow the NAGPRA process.
What are the biggest challenges that you foresee for NAGPRA going forward?
Well, the issue of culturally unidentifiable human remains, which is the way that the regulations have defined this group of human remains that don't have a clear cultural connection. It's a large set of human remains. There are a lot of items in institutions, and the process that's established by the regulations has only been in place for 5 years. And it's a big amount of work on the part of institutions and also for tribes to figure out how best to resolve those human remains.
Is there technology that is available that could help either identify some of those unidentified remains or maybe expedite the process of trying to figure out where they should be going?
The law was created intentionally to balance the different sides of this issue, to balance the needs and information between tribes and museums. And because of that, the law recognizes a lot of different authorities for making decisions about human remains and weighs all of them equally. And by that I mean the law respects cultural traditions, oral history, folkloric traditions, linguistic traditions, in tandem with archaeological evidence and biological evidence. And because the law was created in that manner, I don't really see that technology could make a difference in sort of how the process goes. It may provide opportunities for better and more effective communication between tribes and museums. And I think in that way, technology has really supported NAGPRA and has enabled more work to be done.
Do tribes also face a problem, in addition to having institutions, museums, universities, having remains and other artifacts, that some of those items are held in private collections?
Well, a private collection if it's not subject to NAGPRA, there would be a challenge to getting those objects. There are certainly avenues that tribes have used to get objects back from those private collections, and some private collections have been very forthcoming in following the guidance of NAGPRA, even though they're not required to.
Melanie O'Brien is the new manager for the National NAGPRA program. That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Melanie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
A city village bears a name so unique, those who have researched the community say it doesn't actually mean anything. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more.
On the southern side of South Mountain is the village of Ahwatukee. It's part of the city of Phoenix. Did you know the name Ahwatukee is said to be a Crow Nation language translation for the Spanish title Casa de Sueños, or House of Dreams?
There is no word Ahwatukee in the Crow language, and to say Casa de Sueños in Crow would require a word that sounds nothing like Ahwatukee.
That's Marty Gibson. He's written a book on the history of Ahwatukee. While in his Ahwatukee office, he shows me old photos of Casa de Sueños, the first property built in the area.
So when we talk about Ahwatukee pre-development from 1920 to 1973, Ahwatukee was this house.
The house no longer exists, but it sat near what today is the corner of Sequoia Trail and Appaloosa Drive in an urban community west of the Warner Elliott Loop. Gibson and I took a drive to the area. Casa de Sueños was built in 1920.
So the house would have been pretty much right in the middle of the street here.
It was a 12,000 square foot adobe home on an estimated 7,000 acre property. William Ames was a wealthy Chicago dentist who built the winter home at the foothills of South Mountain. At the time, there was nothing around. He named it Casa de Sueños because it was his and his wife's dream house. It was built with 17 rooms, 7 bathrooms, and had a large courtyard in the center of the home. Ames died 3 months after moving in.
His widow, Virginia Ames, donated. It's not clear exactly how much, but she donated a few sections of land to the city of Phoenix, and that is now part of South Mountain Park.
Mrs. Ames lived in the house in the winter months until her death in 1933. The Ames never had children, so the estate was willed to St. Luke's Hospital. They, in turn, sold Casa de Sueños and the land, now reduced to about 1,200 acres, to another wealthy Midwesterner, Helen Brinton.
She bought it in 1935. She had a thing for the Crow Indian language, and she attempted to translate Casa de Sueños into the Crow language. Came out Ahwatukee. Research decades later confirms that there is no word Ahwatukee in the Crow Indian language.
Gibson says the name caught on. When people were directed to the area east of Chandler, it was known as the Way to Ahwatukee. Brinton lived in the house until her death in 1960. The property was later sold to investors, and by 1975, Ahwatukee was demolished. By the way, when development began in the southern end of South Mountain in the 1970s, there were name suggestions for the area. Gibson says after a while, developers decided to just keep it Ahwatukee, since that is how it was already known. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we should know, please tell us about them. You can find us on email at theshow@kjzz.org. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway still closed at the 101. Traffic is being diverted onto the 101 either north or southbound, so you'll want to avoid that area if you can. Again, 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway closed at the Loop 101. Sunny skies for today through the weekend. Look for a high tomorrow of 104, 106 on Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 16%, some high, thin, puffy clouds, 99 degrees at KJZZ at 252.
KJZZ is supported by Ironwood Cancer and Research Centers. Their comprehensive cancer centers offer support groups for patients, their families, and caregivers. More information available at ironwoodcrc.com.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. An ape is trying to climb on a pole that's 60 feet high. Due to the slippery surface, the ape climbs 3 feet in a minute, only to slip back 2 feet. How much time will it take the ape to reach the top? Hint, the answer is not 60 minutes. When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw 2 names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
For a lot of us, the ukulele might seem like a kid's instrument or one that's an ideal way to hear authentic Hawaiian music. But in the hands of Jake Shimabukuro, it becomes something much more dramatic. He started playing as a little kid with his mom as his teacher.
I started out playing a lot of traditional Hawaiian music. And later when I was in high school, when I was a teenager, a lot of my friends would listen, you know, they'd be listening to the radio and listening to pop tunes and stuff. And I thought, oh, it'd be kind of cool to play some of these recognizable tunes for them. And so I started learning, you know, some pieces. And I remember one of the first songs that I arranged for the ukulele was a song by Extreme, and it was called More Than Words.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big hit way back when. And I remember playing that on the ukulele, and everyone associated that song with the guitar, the acoustic guitar. And I learned it on the ukulele. And I remember people just flipping out and being like, wait, you're not supposed to be able to play that on the ukulele. That's a guitar song. You know, and I think it was kind of since then, you know, from that moment, I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. I loved that reaction, that surprise, you know, reaction from people, because they'd hear that and you know, and it would completely turn them around. Most recently, I did an arrangement for Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, on the ukulele. And when people hear that, it's just, you know, they're like, wow, I never imagined hearing that on the ukulele.
Coming back to what you said about how certain songs are associated with a guitar or another instrument, and for a lot of people, they discovered you through While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and of course, that's obviously associated with a guitar. I do wonder, I mean, the title of the song has guitar in it, Jake, and then you played it on ukulele. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've always been a huge fan of George Harrison and, of course, a huge Beatles fan. But also, I've always felt a connection with George because he was a big fan of the ukulele. You know, and people that know George Harrison really well, you know, they know that he was one of the first ambassadors of the instrument. You know, it was his favorite instrument in the world. He loved the ukulele, and he loved, you know, just traveling with ukulele so that he could get his other buddies to play with him. You know, people like Tom Petty, you know, he and Tom Petty would have jam sessions on the ukulele, or like with Paul McCartney. I mean, all these guys, he got so many people into the instrument, you know, but like something, I mean, just the way you play it. And Paul McCartney actually plays that on the ukulele in his concerts now. He plays Something for George Harrison on the ukulele because, you know, he knew that George was so close to the instrument.
Ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro, he's performing at Tempe's Marquee Theater tonight.
Even if you're thinking about anything but sharks right now, it only takes 2 notes for them to come swimming back to mind. Sharks are an icon on the screen from Spielberg's Jaws release 40 years ago to Discovery Channel's Shark Week going on now. A local aquarium is using the annual cable event as a springboard to educate people about some sharks that don't get a lot of the spotlight. The show's Annika Klein dives deeper into the story.
It's lunchtime at the Sea Life Arizona Aquarium. And that sound is the lunch bell. What's on the menu?
Today they're getting some capelin, some herring, sardines.
sardine, and then we also give them a really big species of fish called bonita.
Cassidy Miller is a sea life aquarist. She feeds the aquarium's black-tip reef sharks by attaching the goodies to a long pole and sticking it into the water, where all sorts of creatures are swimming around. Then suddenly, there's a huge splash.
Most of the time, they eat...
I ask Miller if that was a shark. Was it fighting for the food?
That's actually these fish. They're trevally.
The sharks, it turns out, were not the culprit. In fact, Miller says, they're pretty gentle. It's a very different scene from what you might find on Shark Week.
These sharks are near frenzy now. Here it comes. Got it now. It's pulling hard.
Baiting the sharks with food like a giant ham in turn baits viewers to watch them rip it apart. But some feel these action-packed feeding frenzies could leave viewers with a false impression.
Their lives are just a lot more complex than we think.
Steve Bitter is the curator at Sea Life Arizona. He and his team of aquarists are using this week to focus on their 8 different shark species, with shark feedings, talks, and scavenger hunts.
We try to put kids and all of our guests in a situation where they can really appreciate an animal and really connect with it, and kind of really gain that fascination that drives all of us, I think, to really do what we do.
We also have the epaulette sharks. You might see those right in front of you guys with those black and white spots.
The point of Sea Life's Shark Week is for visitors to get to know sharks face to fin. Tiffany Dressler comes here with her kids about twice a week. So you could say they know these sharks pretty well. One of their favorites is the leopard shark.
He likes to chase it around and around and around.
Dressler also watches Shark Week and says she enjoys the shows, but it's not like she's hooked on the drama.
I mean, they spend hours and hours on the water observing these sharks and tracking them, and then you see the show in 45 minutes, and it's hyped up.
At Sea Life, visitors get a fully unedited show that reveals a surprisingly gentle side to sharks, despite their multiple rows of teeth. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Shark Week at Sea Life Arizona runs through Saturday. And just in case you don't yet think it's safe to go back into the water, plenty of other stuff to do this weekend. You can check out Lady Antebellum, the country music group, will be performing Saturday at Ak-Chin Pavilion. Comedian D.L. Hughley will be at Stand Up Live in Phoenix all this weekend. You can check out the musical Hair at Desert Stages Theater in Scottsdale. The Fred Forney Quintet will be performing tonight at the Nash in Phoenix. And musician J.D. Souther will be performing tonight at MIM in Phoenix. The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.